Anon Radio.
Ice casting on Anon Radio. .net. Ports.
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one,
cut,
zero.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Hello, hello! It is Saturday once again, the 16th of December in the glorious future year of 2023. My greetings go out to everyone in Calm, mostly people with names ending with G, such as Thrig, Stug, and Gemlog. Now, just as a reminder, a step farther out is not unlike the Dubious Goals Committee, which airs
eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one,
cut,
zero.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday, the 1st of June in the glorious future year of 2024. And I am a couple of minutes late because I just dropped in. I had been running around. I visited three estate sales. Did not get any handkerchiefs. One sale did have some, but they were all either lacy or embroidered. But I did get office supplies. I spent less than $20. Total at three sales, but at the first sale I got a comb binder and some white printer paper, which will be good for printing more copies of Blast, obviously, and also some more blueprint paper, which I may finally be able to use to make those cyanotype badges that I've been talking about for well over a year now. So that'll be great. I also bought the world's biggest label maker. It's enormous. and about 1,500 sheets of 18 by 24 inch drawing paper, which is about A1 size in metric paper sizes. Anyway, the comb binder will be very useful. I can use that, for example, on the Man and Atom briefing book. So that'll be great. Now, I want to remind you, of course, that issue number one of Blast is now available. My patrons have been seeing some rough drafts of articles that I want to put into future numbers of Blast. I think I may be able to get out a preliminary version of number two sometime this month. That would be very good. So let's see. Continuing adventures in the payphone thing. As you know, I have gone to great lengths to fit up some old, 1990s German payphones as self-service information kiosks. But of course they have the problem that they're designed to take old Deutschmark coins. Now, as I've mentioned, I found that the British 5p coins and similar, the older, larger size of 5p coins, which are now demonetized. If anybody in Britain wants to collect up old large size 5p coins, I don't know if they're available, you know, at considerably below face value, basically as scrap metal. I'm not sure. Anyway, but now I am fascinated by the prospect of having my own phone tokens struck. And in practice, what I might do is find somebody to overstrike, since I've accumulated about 500 of the pieces that will operate the phones that I have. Right, overstrike them and make Man and Atom tokens, which will then also operate the payphones. That would be really nifty. But as it is, there's sort of the problem that people aren't carrying these things around in their wallets, right? And so if I wanted to use this as any kind of money-making device, I would have to sell people somehow the tokens then to operate the phones. Oh, which seems very awkward. Well, I was looking around for other styles of payphone that could be operated by coins that people actually have, at least here in the U.S. And I did find one. There's, if you look on eBay, there are a whole and other auction sites and places that things are for sale online. You'll very commonly come across something called a CKT-676, or very similar, which is some kind of a pay station telephone. It looks like a regular desk phone, except taller, that was apparently used in hotels and things. Anyway, I found one that was for sale with the original box, which says on it, you know, that you can use it in your own home if your teenagers are hogging the phone or something, which certainly implies that it can be used on a regular phone line and thus presumably on an ATA. But what's more important is that it also comes with a manual, which explains how to set it up. And once I get that, I'm going to scan the manual and put it online for the benefit of other people who want to know how to set it up. Right. But it's set up to accept U.S. quarter dollar coins, which are very common. Most people have them. Right. And so this is potentially, if it works the way I want it to work, which is yet to be seen, this is potentially something that I could take to a convention or other event in the U.S. and have people feed it just with the change that's in their pockets, which would be a very desirable way for that to work, right? That's a way that I could actually get some revenue pretty directly. And again, I'm going to be posting complete information online once, you know, if I get it to work, I'll be posting complete information online of how I did it so that other people can do likewise. One of these estate sales I visited had slot machines, but they wanted $1,500 for one of them. Even though it was full of dimes, it didn't look like any, or at least many of them, were silver dimes, so I didn't think that $1,500, I wasn't going to spend it, even if I had it, which I don't. Anyway, So that's sort of things that I thought were, you know, to keep you up to date with what I'm doing. Now, let's see. While I was out driving around, I noticed these billboards that the school district has put up saying things like, 93% of parents think that their child is doing math at grade level. Only 42% of students are doing math at grade level. And similar for reading. And, of course, without getting into, you know, is grade level the expected value? Is grade level the median? In which case you'd expect 50% of students to be below it anyway, in which case that result isn't very interesting. You know, it certainly does suggest that mathematical illiteracy, innumeracy, if you will, is pretty darn widespread. So that was something that, but again, failure to understand mathematics and quantitative reasoning is pretty widespread. Now, you may have seen an announcement from the Biden administration that they're going to take some measures in support of nuclear power in the United States. I have no confidence that this will actually lead to anything, simply because the very first sentence proves that nobody in the White House press office knows anything about energy whatsoever. They referred to nuclear as providing 19% of American energy last year. Well, would that it were so. The fact is, nuclear fission provided 19% of American electricity. More than half of American electricity demand would have to be met from fission in order for fission to cover 19% of American total energy use. Anyway, you know, and it's speaking of the school system, it's not like I trust them, right? I have all kinds of bad stories about the school system and how people are treated there. But that's not the point. The point is that whatever grade level means, it's pretty clear that parents don't understand what it is. I never found any of the things that I did in public school very challenging. You know, I was reading at what they called a high school level in first grade, so clearly I'm not the person to speak about this. And I can say that for certain because they thought there was something wrong with me, and they sent me to the school psychologist to be evaluated. And the psychologist started giving me these tests, and she quit when she ran out of tests. I know this in some part because my parents actually ran into the school psychologist at a restaurant or something later on. I think she quit, actually, after dealing with me. Because, yeah, they thought I was, in the language of the day, mentally retarded or something. This is back in 1986 or 87, maybe? Anyway. And, yeah, they gave me all the tests that there were, and I ran out the high school level tests. I'm not saying this to brag. I'm saying that I have no idea what the standards are in the public school system. All I know is that I very rarely, when I was there, very rarely did I see anything that seemed like educational activity. Most of the teachers that I encountered were just plain time servers. That's all. So maybe I'm embittered. Anyway, so really, really interesting news out of Europe. So the European Union Parliament, right? The European Parliament passed a law a while back requiring basically environmental labeling standards on products, which works out to essentially that in terms of the energy used to produce a product and transport and so on, some kind of labeling would have to be put on it for environmental impact. And essentially, when faced with two otherwise similar products, the European governments in particular would be under strong pressure to pick the one with the lower number. Well, it didn't specify how this was to be done. That was punted to the European Commission, which is sort of the executive body in the European Union. And so the European Commission has announced its preliminary draft rules, and industries in Germany are screaming bloody murder. Why? Well, because the European Commission has decided that they want to take a simple route. Right. And so, for example, for greenhouse gas emissions associated with energy use in manufacturing, they're talking about going and simply totting up the amount of energy used in producing a product and then multiplying that by the average over the whole country for the greenhouse gas intensity of energy production. Well, a bunch of companies that are building or have built or are about to start construction on, for example, factories for electric car batteries in Germany are suddenly screaming to high heaven, because here's the thing. If we take Germany, according to the statistics, this is like 2019 statistics, but it's not that much different. Germany has a greenhouse gas intensity of 52.27 tons of carbon dioxide per terajoule of energy supply. This compares to 69.6 tons for the People's Republic of China, 28.95 tons for France. So France is at less than 60%, a little more than 50%, say 55% of Germany. If you did it not even based on the energy used to manufacture the product, but just on the price of the product, and then it's the energy intensity per unit of GDP. So in Germany, this is again 2019, 0.18 kilograms carbon dioxide equivalent per U.S. dollar, 2015 U.S. dollar, but that doesn't matter, as long as they're all in the same figure. France, 0.11, PR China, 0.69. So it actually would be a little more favorable to Germany to adopt the energy per dollar of price tag, or euro of price tag, rather than the energy per, carbon dioxide per dollar of price tag versus the carbon dioxide per unit energy absorbed. But all of these firms are screaming to high heaven. They're saying, but what about our renewable energy credits? Because, of course, they've all been paying lots of money for wind and solar installations, which issue them with renewable energy credits. Now, it's not like these factories are powered by wind and solar, right? They're powered by energy that's available all the time, which in Germany is pretty much some combination of coal and gas. But, they've been paying for this, and this has been the major thing which the German government has been using to drive investment in wind and solar projects, is these renewable energy certificates, which businesses which use fossil fuels can then use to greenwash their production. But if these new EC rules go through, the European labeling is not going to take even the slightest account of these emissions credits, these renewable energy certificates. They're going to be as worthless on paper as they are in fact. And that has really put the fox among the chickens. So, German, nuclear exit may come back to haunt them. And if this drives differential investment, because, of course, the thing is, if your industry is located in France with the lowest emissions in the EU, among the lowest emissions in the EU, and you're competing with Germany and Italy and Poland, now Poland is interested in replacing some of its coal with nuclear. Italy could reverse their anti-nuclear policy. I don't see any real sign of them doing that. But just imagine for a moment, that's going to mean if French goods are being purchased, preferentially across the EU because of their very low global warming footprint, then that's going to stimulate industrial investment in Germany, in France, rather, is going to stimulate industrial investment in France, which is going to drive France to build more nuclear power plants, because that's what works. That's the foundation of their success. And so the question is, are the other European countries going to imitate that? Is Spain, for example, going to reverse its nuclear exit policy, start building nuclear power plants in order to bring in industry from the anti-nuclear countries, such as Germany? I find this prospect very interesting. Now, obviously, the EC rules are going to be debated, right? This isn't, you know, the first draft is not necessarily what gets enacted. And so there's going to be a lot of pressure from businesses in Germany not to enact a standard like this. On the other hand, it's very convenient in an administrative sense not to have to try and do a life cycle analysis on every single product that comes up for evaluation. That is simply a really difficult job. And particularly when you're looking at products from inside the EU, comparing them with products from outside the EU. Obviously, not every product offered from outside the EU is going to have the kind of documentation necessary for this. And one could certainly imagine a situation in which the EC is pressured into making different rules for products from within the EU and products from outside the EU, right? For outside the EU, it just goes with countries either average, you know, CO2 per terajoule, or goes with countries average CO2 per euro of GDP, right? We can imagine that happening. And then inside the EU, products being more closely looked at. But that still doesn't guarantee that these renewable energy certificates are going to mean anything. And personally, I would love to see a situation in which those renewable energy certificates got dumped, essentially. Right, got made worthless. Because ultimately, the main thing that they do is encourage this business of emissions trading and so on, which is essentially just another way for the market traders, in other words, market participants who are neither producers nor consumers, to step in and skim some money off the top, which has to be paid for either by an either out of consumer prices, right? Either they're taking money off of you, the consumer, or they're shorting the producer. And if they short the producer, of course, that means the producer can't invest in new and better equipment, etc., etc., etc. And then there's a small item here. I may get a little, not quite poetical here, but a little abstract here, because I occasionally run into people who just have plain bad opinions. And now, you know, everybody's entitled to an opinion, but when your opinion is based on some kind of inference or claim of fact, and the claim of fact, I may disagree with it, right? One of the things that I see in certain left political circles, it's become popular to claim that it's impossible for everyone in the world to have a so-called first world standard of living, on the grounds that industrial society itself, by some kind of internal logic, demands what they call colonization and extraction zones. In other words, the idea that somehow industrial society can't exist without massive inequality because there has to be somebody who is giving up resources for far less than they're worth to the people who use them, that there has to be some place that wastes are being dumped, etc. And I just don't believe that. Firstly, I don't believe it because I don't think the historical evidence supports it. The historical evidence seems to me that industrialization spreads to poorer areas and makes them less poor. You know, obviously. I mean, India is an example. India is moving up slowly. China moving up more rapidly, although they've had some really serious problems. You know, the progress has been very slow and over most of Africa. A lot of Africa is still very extractive, right? Very much things are being dug out of the ground and shipped somewhere else for someone else to enjoy, and the people locally aren't getting a lot of benefit out of it. But as I have reported before, for example, in Nigeria, they're beginning to build fertilizer plants around their oil refineries, things like that, which are actually good for the local people. It's not just oil being shipped abroad to be burned by Europeans and Americans and small cliques getting money and weapons in return. Hell, if you go and you look at, and I've got a copy of it on my shelf, the Belgian 1958 plan for the development of the Congo, you realize that the objective of it was to raise the Congo to European standards of living by sometime around the year 2000. You know, it was a 40-year plan. So I think that the historical evidence is very, very dubious about this. I think it's a theoretical construct which lacks adequate evidentiary justification, but I also feel as though it is a self-serving lie perpetrated by people who do not, cannot, and most importantly, do not want to understand what it means to be touched by the finger of Vulcan. Now, that is one of those things that I'm going to just bring in a metaphor here and leave you to think about it, but I truly, genuinely do believe that there is such a thing as the human impulse to create, the human impulse, as I once said to a religious foundation which was offering me a college scholarship, but that's not important, as I once said, to participate in the work of creation. I genuinely believe that is a major part of the human experience, but it's not a part of everyone's experience. And many people who are deeply into certain kinds of politics, for example, that's so far out of their experience that not only have they never experienced it or anything like it, they do not understand it, they cannot understand it, and they don't want to understand it. All I ask for is politicians who want to understand, right? I don't ask for politicians who are engineers, right? I don't ask for Herbert Hoover for president. What I ask for is people in politics who want to understand what it means to use the human creative intellect and tool-using faculty to harness the forces of nature to make the world a better place for us. You know, that's key. And, of course, it's also true that there are, you know, technologists are often criticized, castigated by certain people in political and similar positions for just not understanding people. And there are some who don't, right? But the great defect of C.P. Snow's two cultures argument is not that engineers don't get into arts, because they absolutely do. It's that people in the arts, people in politics, don't get into engineering. So that's, you know, that is my position. I genuinely believe that to be an engineer is to be a creative person. If you've ever met any, you'd know that. I don't know. My father is a scientist. He wrote a history book. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on anonradio.net, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll probably read them out on the show. I'll probably send you something in return. That's also the address to which to...